This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we target mainly people displaced by the conflict. This is our main focus. People have to flee their homes, have to run away. We assist these people. We have a huge setup here in South Sudan. We employ about 1,000 people. We operate 10 aircraft, cargo aircraft, passenger aircraft, two helicopters to run these operations.
That's Jörg Eglin, the head of the ICRC delegation in South Sudan. He's commenting on ICRC food airdrops. Details coming up.
Also, Joseph Kony's communication chief in the Lord's Resistance Army has surrendered, and Kenya's High Court has given Parliament 60 days to pass a law that requires more women to be lawmakers.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the man in charge of communications for the Lord's Resistance Army leader, Joseph Kony, has surrendered. The Associated Press reports Michael Omona gave himself up to Ugandan forces in the Central African Republic. A Ugandan military spokesman says the surrender shows the degraded capacity of LRA rebels. The LRA began as a rebel movement in Uganda in the 1980s and was known for kidnapping thousands of children and killing many civilians. It also attacks civilians in the DRC, Central African Republic, and what is now South Sudan. Omona himself had been abducted by the LRA in 1994 before rising through the ranks. Observers believe there are now only about 100 members left who are scattered in small groups throughout the region. The U.S. recently announced it was withdrawing from the manhunt for Kony, who's wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Uganda is part of a U.N. mission trying to find him.
As the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan worsens, the International Committee of the Red Cross has been airdropping emergency food supplies. The food aid is being delivered to several locations affected by both famine and conflict. Jörg Eglin is the head of the ICRC delegation in South Sudan. He says the airdrops had been planned for the past year as the situation deteriorated. From the capital, Juba, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kapowa about the airdrops.
We target mainly people displaced by the conflict. This is our main focus. People have to flee their homes, have to run away. We assist these people. We have a huge setup here in South Sudan. We employ about 1,000 people. We operate 10 aircraft, cargo aircraft, passenger aircraft, two helicopters to run these operations. Food drops is one part of this. We do food drops into these remote areas that are inaccessible by road. That means cargo airplanes overfly these villages. They drop food to an identified drop zone. And people on the ground then organize communities and distribution so food goes to the right people.
Where are these drops taking place? Can you give me a few of the regions or the towns where you're dropping these supplies?
Yep. Just a couple of weeks ago, we were very much present and working in this place called Unity, Lair. That was a place we had been working for a long period of time. At the same time, this is a very difficult place, so we had to evacuate our teams there repeatedly over the last 2 years. And we had actually been assisting about 60,000 people just last month with food rations. We are not alone here. We work with others. We coordinate with others. WFP is also one of the big players, and they also assist in the same region now, and we have kind of shared the workload, and they do part of it in this particular part of the county, which is seen as a bit center of these food needs. Yeah. There are other places with equal needs. We currently drop food just a bit further northeast of Unity, of Lair, what I spoke before, in the Jonglei region, that accommodates a lot of displaced people coming from Malakal, which is a town further up north in the Upper Nile. We also pay now particular attention to the very south of the countries, the Equatorias. We have seen a lot of conflict, a lot of displacement in this part. The needs are slightly different there because people have gone to Uganda, have gone to the DRC. They're refugees, But the remaining people, they have needs, and we try to address them there.
What happens once the food is airdropped? Are there people on the ground to help distribute it?
That's a very good question. Actually, before the airdrop can take place, we send people in. We cannot just go there blindly, if you want. We first establish a relationship with the communities, with the authorities on the ground. We organize the communities. We establish lists of beneficiaries. We agree on those lists with the community leaders. And only once this is done, we call in the airplanes for the food drops. Once the food is dropped in these drop zones, we have groups of people going in, often volunteers from the local Red Cross. They go in, pile up those food stocks, and then distribution takes place to the individual families.
Would you tell us what type of food aid is being airdropped? What's in those packages?
The bulk of the food is sorghum. This is a staple food here, and also beans. These are the two main groups to cover the basic needs in terms of protein and carbohydrates. And then we have supplements depending a bit on the region. Sometimes we have very specific foods that is helping mother and their small children to cope better. And then also we add oil, we add salt, sugar, depending a bit on the context. And some of the stuff cannot be dropped from the air. So some of the stuff we have to fly in with smaller aircraft, which we land in these villages and add them to the distribution.
Now, airdrops are very, very expensive. How much is this operation costing?
We have a budget and an appeal out in the range of $130 million. So that is actually for our entire operation for 2017 here in South Sudan. In this type of environment operation, the logistics cost and the cost to operate these very expensive aircraft are very high. And so we have really to ask for more funds to be able to cover that. And people have to understand it is not an easy go. It is costly, but if you want to be effective, you have to have these means at your disposal.
Do you have any idea how long you can maintain these airdrops? Do you have a timetable?
We adapt our response depending how the situation evolves. Now we are in this acute crisis situation, hence we added more of these capacities for food drops. And we actually hope that we can start phasing out once the harvest comes in. The rains start slowly, slowly now. We hope the agriculture season will be favorable, that people can plant. And most importantly, we hope, of course, for more stability and the peace to come so people can actually cope better and face their lives better. And then we can change our efforts instead of doing these expensive food drops and then focus more on the support of agriculture production, of livestock health, of the health as such for the people, and do more development-oriented programming.
Jörg Egeland is the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross delegation in South Sudan. From Juba, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kepawa.
A judge has dealt another blow to President Trump's revised travel ban. In the state of Hawaii, U.S. District Judge Derek Watson, the same judge who issued a temporary restraining order against it, has turned the order into a preliminary injunction. The injunction prohibits the Trump administration from following through on the president's executive order while it's being considered by the courts. Hawaii's attorney general, who led the legal fight against the administration, says the injunction has no expiration date. The case is now expected to go to the Court of Appeals. The revised ban would affect new arrivals from six mostly Muslim nations. An estimated 146 migrants are feared missing after their boat capsized off the coast of Libya yesterday. The vessel left either Sunday or Monday from Sabratha, western Libya, heading to Italy. A Gambian man is the only reported survivor. He told the United Nations Refugee Agency from his hospital bed that the boat was carrying passengers from Nigeria, Mali, and the Gambia. These included five children and several pregnant women. Meanwhile, Austria has told the EU that it does not want to accept any more refugees, arguing that it has already taken in enough. Reported Josephine McKenna has the latest developments from Italy.
It's believed that 146 people have drowned off the coast of Libya in the latest tragedy on the Mediterranean. The IOM, the UN Migration Agency, says there's only one survivor from this tragedy, a Gambian who was rescued and taken to Lampedusa. And there are still hopes of trying to find other survivors, but that looks very grim. Most of the passengers are believed to have come from Nigeria, Mali and Gambia, according to media reports. And the boat started taking on water just a few hours after setting off from the coast of Libya. Since the beginning of the year, we believe nearly 600 migrants have died or gone missing, according to estimates from the International Organization for Migration.
Yes, and I understand the man that was rescued was by a Spanish military ship participating in the EU's Operation Sophia.
Last week, we also had the Spanish group Proactiva Open Arms discover two other capsized dinghies. So there were concerns there that hundreds of others had been packed onto those vessels and died last week. So the Spanish have been very active in the Mediterranean, and as we know, it's a multi-country operation involved with government vessels and also NGOs that are taking part in various rescues.
Meanwhile, I understand that Austria has bluntly told the EU that it does not want to accept any more refugees.
Austria has told the European Union that it does not want to accept any more refugees, saying that it has already accepted enough. Vienna wants an exemption from receiving any more migrants and asylum seekers. And this is a blow to the EU, which is trying to take some of the pressure off Italy and ensure that other countries do take more migrants. It also coincides with a tightening of security and immigration rules that we've seen in other countries like Hungary and Greece and Switzerland. Austria accepted 90,000 asylum seekers in 2015. That's around 1% of its population. But that has also fueled a rise in support for the far-right Freedom Party, which still leads in the opinion polls there. Now, fewer than 14,500 asylum seekers have been relocated from Greece and Italy. So the EU countries really are being called upon to do far more to accept these refugees. Italy accepted 180,000 migrants last year and is expecting up to 250,000 in 2017. We've already seen more than 20,000 arrivals in Italy, and this flow of migrants on boats across the Mediterranean shows absolutely no sign of slowing down.
Also, there's an update on the situation from a couple of weeks ago where there was a fire at a refugee center, and I understand today there's some new information regarding that.
Yes, you might remember just a couple of weeks ago there was some conflict at an asylum seekers reception center in Puglia in southern Italy. There was alleged rioting and there was a fire at that center. Migrants then had to be relocated, and now police have arrested 26 migrants that's allegedly involved in those riots, and they are facing charges ranging from setting fire to the building, bodily harm and resisting arrest. Of course, from the migrants, we've heard extraordinary stories of overcrowding and difficult conditions in some of these centres. We've also understand that there have been allegations that these migrants feel that they are being exploited and manipulated by gangs that organise migrants in that region for farm work, harvesting tomatoes and other kinds of vegetables. This is an ongoing issue for Italy, whether migrants are being exploited and how they're being treated in their migrant centres where they're being housed.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Nineteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. A new study shows child marriage remains widespread in sub-Saharan Africa. Researchers at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, say one-third of girls in over half of 31 countries reviewed still marry before age 18. Elisa Koski is a co-author of the study and a postdoctoral scholar at the Fielding School of Public Health at the University of California, Los Angeles. Reporter William Eagle asked her which countries scored the lowest and highest for child marriage rates.
We found the highest rates of child marriage in some of the countries in sort of West and Central Africa, including Chad, Niger, and Mali. where over 60% of girls continued to be married before reaching their 18th birthday. And those are also the countries where we found the highest prevalence of marriage among the very youngest girls. So 20 to 30% of girls in those countries are married before their 15th birthday.
West Africa as a region, I understand, is among those with the highest numbers of child marriages. Why is that? Is it strictly cultural?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons that families choose to marry off their girls early. One of the foremost is economic. Young girls in some cultures are seen as a source of stored capital. So essentially, at the time of marriage, they can be exchanged for goods, livestock, even cash. This is often referred to as a bride price, where the groom's family pays the bride's family in some manner. So I think those economic reasons that really drive child marriage are often sort of combined with traditional, cultural, or even religious justifications that sort of mask some of the more base economic drivers. There's also a final reason would be, I think there's a possibility that in some limited cases, child marriage is seen as possibly protective against HIV infection in some parts of Africa, where a lot of HIV prevention programs have focused on monogamy or on limiting the number of partners. The idea of marrying off a girl very young would be seen as sort of protective against some risky sexual behaviors.
Your study also notes that a drop in child marriages in some countries like Senegal and Kenya have stalled, or they are remaining flat. And others where there had been progress, like Nigeria, it appears to be rising. What again accounts for this?
Unfortunately, in this study, we can't pinpoint exactly what accounts for stalled progress in any individual country. So I can't say with any certainty what has led to stalled progress in Senegal or Kenya specifically. But I can comment more generally. So I think what accounts for continuing high rates of child marriage and some of the stalled progress would be that some of these countries still legally permit child marriage. All of these countries have set a minimum legal age at marriage of 18 years, but the vast majority of them still allow children below that age to be legally married if their parents consent to it or if a judicial or religious authority consents to it. So this can perpetuate child marriage at some base level amongst communities where it's still considered acceptable or part of their social norms or traditions. I think there's also a troubling lack of enforcement of these laws. Malawi, where until very recently, actually until last month, Malawi had set a minimum legal age at marriage at 18, but permitted girls as young as 15 to be married if their parents gave the okay. But our study found that 10% of girls were married even prior to their 15th birthday. So this sort of indicates that there's a substantial amount of sort of extra legal child marriage still occurring. So enforcement is a problem as well.
Countries have pledged to eliminate child marriage by 2030 as part of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Is that done by changing the culture at the grassroots level, convincing families that girls can be, for example, an economic asset? Or is it done by stricter government enforcement of laws limiting child marriage?
I do think that it's unlikely that these laws alone are going to be effective at eliminating child marriage by 2030. I think improving the status of girls within their communities is absolutely necessary. Seeing them less as a source of capital and, most importantly, perhaps, valuing their education. We've done some other work that's not yet published that really shows that making education more accessible for girls by eliminating tuition fees So essentially reducing the cost for families of sending girls to school is an effective mechanism for preventing child marriage in many countries throughout sub-Saharan Africa.
That was Alisa Koski, the co-author of a study on early marriage in Africa. She spoke with VOA's William Eagle.
Tunisia's foreign minister, Kamais Janawi, recently visited Washington, where he talked with U.S. officials about closer economic and security ties. VOA reporter Mohamed El-Shanawi asked Tunisian ambassador to Washington, Faisal Gouaya, for more details about the meetings.
The visit by Minister Janawi to Washington was a real success. And as you mentioned, we talked with the American officials about economic, military, and security partnership and the support that the United States can provide Tunisia with in this very important time of its history. And we found all kind of support to Tunisia because they consider Tunisia as a good example in the region. On the economic side, we talked about the upcoming bilateral meetings we have together, especially the TIFA Council meeting that will take place next month in April in Tunis. We talked also about the meeting of the Joint Economic Commission. This is a commission, bilateral commission, that exists only with Tunisia. It will take place in May 2017. On the military side and security, we talked about the upcoming meeting of the Joint Commission. And also, we found all kind of support from the economic officials in the United States about the possibility of negotiating a free trade agreement. The new administration is favorable to bilateral agreement and bilateral economic agreement, and the perspectives look very promising.
So how would you describe the possible changes in ties between the new U.S. administration and Tunisia?
Personally, I'm expecting positive changes. Tunisia and the President of the Republic of Tunisia was among the very first head of states to be called on by the President of the United States. The call took place on February 17, and it was a very warm and positive conversation between the two presidents. And they talked about bilateral relations, but also they talked about the future of the relations, the perspectives, but also they talked about peace and security in the region, especially in the neighboring country, Libya.
One common concern, Mr. Ambassador, between the U.S. and Tunisia is how to end the civil war in Libya and reach a peaceful and political solution. What was the Trump administration's response to Tunisian President Baji Qaid Sibsi's initiative on Libya?
The initiative of President Qaid Sibsi on Libya was warmly welcomed by the U.S. official. President Baji Qaid Sibsi of Tunisia took the initiative to launch discussions with his counterparts in Algeria and Egypt, and he was very successful to bring these two neighboring countries of Libya to speak one voice and to join Tunisia for an initiative to help Libyans solve their crisis.
That was Tunisia's ambassador to the U.S., Faisal Gouaya. He was speaking with reporter Mohamed El-Shanawi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdelrahman, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you.
Mabao, Mabao, Mabao,
the African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.